Today's podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
All right, let's get back in here for another Diamond Conversation here on the Place to Be Nation podcasting network. If you didn't know by now, my name is Ian, and every single week we sit down to have a Diamond Conversation with another guest from the baseball world, this time taking a trip out to the West Coast, to the west side of this great land, as we talk to and welcome in former Major League veteran, Mr. Richard Rodriguez, joining us tonight. Rich, how you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
It's great to have you on. It's great to talk about things that you did in your career, but also to talk about Elite Nine. A very cool and very neat endeavor that you've bestowed upon, and I can't wait to hear about it. Tell us a little bit about what you're up to these days.
Well, right now, we created an Elite Nine for the former Major League Baseball players to empower them and promote their baseball ability throughout the country. And most of these guys have so much a wealth of knowledge that they needed to share with their instruction or their baseball facilities. So what we did was most of these guys have played most of their life playing baseball. Some of them are college educated. Some of them came right out of high school. So they didn't have a lot of time to market, building a business, things like that while they were playing baseball. So when they get out of baseball, they open some facilities, and some of them found out that they're just by putting their name on the advertisement wasn't going to make a lot of drawing compared to some of the other facilities that didn't have as much knowledge. Some minor league guys or some ex-college guys had facilities and being a little bit more successful because of their marketing skills. So what we did was we created Elite Nine so it would have a center place for MLB players and facilities to go to, be hosted on a site so there it can be marketed correctly. Along with that, what I would travel around California and we would introduce ourselves to the little leagues, to the recreation parks out there, and we would around the area would be other facilities. For example, you'd have guys like Greg Jeffries up in San Francisco and two other guys, Jamal Leach would be out there as well. And then we would find a central located place to host a camp and recruit these kids and market these kids in that area. And at the end of this camp, we would have Jalal Leach and Greg Jeffries and only MLB instructors there. And we would host this camp. And at the end of the camp, we would market the two facilities. So at the end of the day, these kids would have an opportunity to visit these new facilities and get to know these guys during the camp and recruit from there. So that was the business model of that, was what we do, is the way to get these kids in front of Major League Baseball players and also show the Major League Baseball players how we can work together and use our skills and our knowledge to enhance the game of baseball and share our abilities and our experiences.
Yeah, and the mission statement, teaching the players of the future by uniting the players of the past. I mean, you can't go any way wrong with that statement because, personally, I would have loved to have learned from a former pro growing up and seen things that I could have fixed in my, little league days that maybe it would have changed my fortunes and I could have gone on to my own superstardom. But you see this right now, presently, an argument that goes online all the time. And it's, the players of the past, like yourself, versus guys that really never had a touch of major league success or really even professional success that are out there charging kids an arm and a leg to learn what? To learn what they think works. Basically the professional armchair quarterback or armchair baseball thrower or hitter, you know what I mean? So it's really cool that you brought that together to bring players from the past to unite with these, players of the future, perhaps, because I think that you guys are the only tool that people should be learning from.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. And here's how we all feel about that is that, if I want to climb a mountain, I want to climb Mount Everest, and I want to go to a guy who actually climbed Mount Everest. That's my philosophy, if I can use that analogy. And another thing too, when you get to certain levels of Major League Baseball, of baseball in general, the speed increases. So when the speed increases, so does the mindset and the reaction time. So the game is played at the fastest speed in Major League Baseball. So when you're asking, when you're learning how to process your way and make adjustments in Major League Baseball, it's at the quickest speed available or possible. So when you're teaching these kids about how to see the game at a certain speed, their speed is so slow that we can analyze it much easier. And as we as they move up, as we have young kids or say the 8, 9, 10 little league level, 12 little league level, then the high school level, and then the college level, we understand and had success at all those levels of that speed. Then you get to the minor league level, it's the same thing. A ball, double A, triple A, the speed increases more and the consistency increases more. And the adjustments and guys trying to figure out how to make an adjustment on the fly to correct the first mistake they made against a hitter or a hitter against a pitcher. It's a chess match using your skill set. And when you get to the major league level, you got to do that every day, day in and day out. And that's what I feel that the Major League Baseball players have to offer as opposed to everybody else. We see it at the fastest speed possible. We've made adjustments and corrections to have a percentage that's going to keep us in the major leagues for a long time. So we can pass that on to the youth and teach them the right foundation of what we need to do to go to each level. Some guys stopped at A ball. Some guys stopped in college ball. They never knew that speed. They never knew to enhance their ability to make adjustments, to problem solve on the fly, and have enough experience and over time to polish those skill sets up, and then basically have some kind of formula to use to stay in the major leagues is basically what you're trying to do. So that's what I think. That's what I really feel so strongly about, and feel so fortunate to be around the MLB guys. Not only that, what's really awesome, really neat, is that when we get these camps together with all these MLB guys, they start to share stories. They start to talk about, well, why do you believe in this philosophy or your stance or this philosophy in pitching? Or why do you feel your approach to these pitching counts or these hitting counts? And then all this information just starts to fly around and everybody starts to fine tune their way of approaching the game of baseball. And it's really, really neat to see those skull sessions go on with these kids, these Major League Baseball players from all over the country.
Yeah, it's so cool. I mean, in the roster of guys that you have, the instructors that are under your umbrella, it's such a vast, you know, different array of talent and guys that have different skill sets. So how did you go about recruiting the instructors? Or is it guys that you just were friendly with over the years, or guys that you know, found throughout, you know, your travels were perfect for what you were looking for?
Well, a few things. A couple of guys that I knew before. I remember sitting down while, you know, with Greg, guys like Greg Jeffries. I came up to him with the minor leagues. We both I got traded from the Mets to the Padres, and then we finally connected back in St. Louis together halfway through my career. But I already knew that he was a guy that always was on the cutting edge. You know, him and his father up there in San Francisco were on the cutting edge of
right, exactly.
Drilling. Do you remember that when the underwater swinging with the bat?
Yep.
Even though if it was good or not, it just showed to me that there was an approach there, that they were trying to find a way to enhance skill set. So that guy was the first on my list. And then little by little, we started getting into talking about hitting, and guys like Dimitri Young and guys like Robert Fick. Those guys were, all hitting day in and day out was their approach. And, you know, we had some great guys like Mike Lieberthal, Rene Gonzalez. I grew up in Rene out there in the San Gabriel Valley. Another great instructor, Brett Barbary, and I, we played together in Florida. So guys that I and then one, the way it would work was one guy would mention another guy. And so here we are, we're going up to San Francisco to talk to Jalal Leach. And he's also scouting for the New York Mets. And right now he's scouting for the Major League, scouting for the San Francisco Giants. So, you know, we go up to San Francisco and we introduce ourselves to him. And we'd say, this is what we're all about. And we really love your facility as well. And they're like, I'm on board. How can we do this? And so I would just take off up there and we would connect with, like I said, the local recreation, the little leagues. They introduce ourselves to them, and little by little, the word of mouth, they'd all get together and they'd say, okay, you have our whole list, mark it away. So we would market to their little league. We design all the websites, all the e-flyers. We design all that for them. We give it to their website. They put it on there. We give them discounts. At some points, we even give them money to start up their concession stands. You know, things
that are
innovative for that. We can say, listen, we're going to give you off the top. We're going to give you $500. And what they would do was pretty neat. During these camps, they would open the concession stands. They would use that money as startup, and then they would charge the kids for lunch, which was, we were on board with that, and usually double that money. So so we found a little formula to enhance, not only give a discount for the tickets, but also to enhance their profit margin by offering the startup cost for their concessions. So it was a win-win situation for everybody, and the instructors learned so much. We got to get a rapport with the kids. We got to the other guys in the other facilities. They got to learn what it was like, how to connect with the community, and not expect them just to come to the door because they were just Major League Baseball players. So they learned a lot about that, and like I said, I learned so much about pitching from other pitching instructors and hitters, what they were thinking, and it was really neat to have that skull session at the end of the day.
You know, you mentioned Jeffries right off the top. I mean, and he was, when he finally hit the majors, I mean, it was like, you know, it was a big deal that he was the only guy who had done that kind of stuff, the swinging underwater and all the extra, you know, I always say like the traveling style of baseball player. That who else had really hit the majors by that point in the late 80s? And he, you know, his career started off interesting because of it, because it didn't make a lot of friends, you know, right away. But you going through the minor leagues with them, I find it fascinating. We've talked to a couple of guys who came through that same Met minor league system at that time. It's an interesting time to be in the organization because it is such, you know, it was such a juggernaut at that point. But talk about getting drafted. I know you were drafted twice, but talk about getting drafted by the Mets and kind of starting to work your way through that minor league system.
Well, like I said, I got drafted twice. The first time was by the Royals out of high school, but my second time out of University of Tennessee, where I went to school. I got drafted by the Mets, and they sent me to upstate New York in a place called Little Falls, New York, which was, you know, for me coming from San Gabriel, California, going to Knoxville, Tennessee was a culture shock in itself. But then also going from Knoxville, Tennessee to upstate New York and Little Falls, New York, which was a beautiful field, by the way. But it was pretty exciting for me. You know, I was thrilled to finally play professional baseball. And I learned, I got to that team. We had guys like Kevin Elster on the team. We had Craig Jeff. You know, it was a pretty – Dave West as a pitcher. We had, you know, I think we had, I don't know how many guys, six or seven guys come off of that minor leagues team right there. We wind up winning the division there. But, you know, I was really green. I mean, I came as a starter to the Mets organization. And they pitched me one day on opening day. And they came back and they pitched me the following day. And they gave me a day off. And then they pitched me again. And as being a starter, I turned out to be a reliever. As soon as I got to Little Falls, I said, I want you to go over there to that bench over there in right field, and that's where you're going to sit till we call you. And I was, okay. So I went over there and sat down. They pitched me 3 out of 4 days, and I went to the coach, and I told him, I said, sir, I just can't pitch that much. You're going to need to give me a few days in between to get some rest before you call my number again. And I had no idea what I was thinking. I mean, I'm their property. My arm is their property. If they want to throw me every day, they can throw me every day. And he looked at me funny and he said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to give you the day off, but just be prepared tomorrow to be pitching again. And I said, yes, sir. So he goes, just put your running shoes on and go out to the bullpen, stay there. So I put my running shoes on and I went out there and I sat there and the guy's looking at me going, Richie, you got your wrong shoes on. What's going on? I said, oh, I had to talk with the coach. And they said, what? And I said, oh, I had to talk with the pitching coach. And I told him that he can't be throwing me so much. He said, you did what? And I said, I told him that he's pitching you way too much and I need a few days in between. And they all started laughing there. I go, you got some big, you know what? Because, you know, you're the property of the Mets now. And this is how this works, you know? And I was in shock. I'm like, I don't know, what was I thinking to do that? So turns out that I was kind of a guy that would throw 70, 71 games a season, you know, 60 to 71. And sometimes I was on paces to go 100 games in a season. So even though I felt that way early in my career, it turned out that I was workhorse as the years went on. I learned how to pitch day after day. But on that team, we won the league that year. I remember we beat Newark, New York, to win the title. It was the Orioles organization. I think they had Bell was one of the pitchers they had there, the lefty for the Orioles organization, which was nice to win a division the first time. I didn't get to see another ring till 2000 with the Mets again in the World
That's
Series.
Right.
So it was nice. I got my first minor league ring with the Mets, and then I got my first, at least National League championship with the New York Mets as well. But what a great team. Buddy Harrelson was my head coach, and that was a thrill for me. I had no idea. I mean, I grew up on the West Coast with those teams, and then, you know, people talking like, oh, you're so lucky to have Buddy Harrelson as a manager. And I was like, so then you started doing some research, and like, wow, this guy's pretty popular. Everybody loved the guy. He was a great, great manager, good communicator. So I was really, really fortunate to have an organization that was so strong, because I remember when Roger McDowell was getting called up, Randy Myers was getting called up, and everybody was all through the system. Everybody was excited. Oh, Roger just got called. Who's Roger? Because I'm new to the organization. Who's Randy? Who's Rick Aguilera? Who are these guys? You know, and everybody was so excited. And I'm like, well, we're a pretty strong organization. And then, you know, you go to spring training the next year, instructional league after that, and you're like, wow, we are stacked from the low A ball. I think we had seven levels at the time, seven levels in the minor
system.
And I'm like, I'm never going to get out of eight ball, you know, at seven levels. But I'm very fortunate.
You would have been in that 1990 mix where they could have used you coming out of the pen, and they let you go in 1989. But that whole, like I said, it was a juggernaut, and it seemed like all the guys that were coming through the system ended up playing an integral part, not only for that team, but would go on and be integral parts of other teams, like Rick Aguilera being an integral part of the Twins, and same thing with Dave West. These guys would all go on. So you leave the Mets organization for the first time. You're outside of the Met walls. Was it a little bit of a shock to you to get used to another person's or another team's protocol and all that good stuff that comes with switching teams?
Well, you know, here's the good news. The Mets organization, which John Cumberland, guys like that, they really taught us when we would do our stretching and in instructional league with the Mets. The league we had. It was called the Arizona League now. Well, that's what we had after the season ended in the minor leagues. They pick you and they go to an instructional league, and we go there and we think, you know, John Cumberland would have talks with us and says, well, we're stretching, you know, listen, guys, you know, I know you all want to be a Met, and I get that, but let's get real about this. We're trying to be a Major League Baseball player, and that is our goal. So at the time, we had 27 teams. He's like, you have 27 teams across your chest. So you play the game of baseball, you can make it to the major leagues, and it's hopefully you'll get there as a Met, but if you don't, that's your goal as a play. So, you know, so when guys would get traded, you know, we would be kind of prepared, like, okay, we're trying to be a Major League Baseball player no matter what uniform we are on. Yes, I might have grown up a Dodger fan or an Angel fan, or some guys in the East Coast or the Mets, the Yankees, you know. But he said, so they prepared us very well to get there. And when I did make a change, I went to the San Diego Padres. They traded me over to the San Diego Padres. And I get on a team with Ricky Bonet, Andy Benes. We have Doug Brokel. We have Dave Holland at third, Warren Newsom in right field. We have all these pitchers. I think six of the major of the pitchers are the 10 on the staff. Six of them make it to the major leagues, and about five of them, Omar Oliveras, another pitcher. So we had, you know, and then St. Louis Cardinals had a nice. It was always the Mets, the Giants, and the St. Louis Cardinals. As far as I'm concerned, was always the rivalries. Mets had good organizations.
Yeah.
Giants had good organizations, and the St. Louis Cardinals had always had these good minor league organizations, and we were always either fighting with the San Francisco Giants or going to championship games with the St. Louis Cardinals organization. So it was a good adjustment. I went to Double A with the Padres, we actually did go to the finals in the playoffs as well, and got beat by the St. Louis Cardinals in that first year. But we had a lot of talent on that team, and so they were very strong there. And I think they did it on purpose. I think they weren't as strong up and down the line for minor league system. So I think what they did was they stacked that Double A team, and not a lot of those guys got to Triple A. They were there for a little while, and then we were up. But within a month and a half, the following year, we were all in the major leagues. So I think Andy went right out of spring training, and the rest of us followed. Omar Oliveras, Ricky Bonet, myself, Doug Brokel. We all, but none, and some of them didn't make it up with the Padres. Like you said, Omar Oliveras came up with the St. Louis Cardinals. I believe Doug Brokel came up with the Houston Astros. So I was fortunate to stay with the Padres. Andy came up, and I both came up with the Padres. I think Ricky came up for a little bit, and then he got traded to Kansas City right away.
Mm-hmm.
So it was great. It was great to be around that kind of talent and learn what it was like to be almost like an instructional league team. What it was like to be around so much talent that's what a major league team environment would be like. And a lot of those guys are dedicated. Those guys are really, really dedicated to their craft. It was really neat. You saw their work ethic before the game. You're like, okay, these guys are professionals, and this is what it's going to look like to get in the major leagues. So it was a good, nice prep for me to get there. Not that I knew I was going to get there. I was hoping I was going to get there, but I knew I had a chance once I came over to the Padres organization because they wasn't stacked. I know I wasn't having to beat Jesse Orosco, Rick Aguilera. I wasn't going to have to beat Randy Myers, Doug Brook, Roger McDowell. You know, it was going to be tough to break into that whole bullpen in New York. So it was a blessing for me to get – maybe they did it as a favor to me, but they pulled me out, put me in an organization which was not as stacked as a New York team was.
Telling you, one more year, they would have used you in 90. They would have needed you in 1990, yeah. But that's the way baseball goes. But, you know, I look at the teams that you were on, and you know, when I remember watching a lot of these teams back in the day, and it always seemed like the good mix of the vets and the younger guys and how, you know, they mesh well and they can give you the experience, they can give you the hot-shotting of the young guys. So as a younger guy and then becoming a veteran down the road, would you find somebody that you could kind of go to talk to get advice? Would it be a coach? Would it be another pitcher? Who's somebody that you kind of single out early in your career and be like, I want to talk to him, and then later on, I want to be him as an older player?
Right. There was a combination of guys that were really good. There's an old school. I played from 1990 to 2003, and during that period of time, it went from Budweiser to protein shakes. from around 1996, 97, you know, I remember we're on a plane one time and one of the flight attendants came over and sat down and said hello. And I said, how you doing? Because we see them all the time. And she's like, this is the first time. This is like 1997. This is the first time we've ran out of water on a charter flight. And I said, what? She's like, we've run out of water. We never run out of water. So you could tell guys were staying hydrated. They were doing things for changing. But early on, it was a whole different mindset. I mean, guys that I really – that gravitated towards me, that I was really quiet early on, just trying to make – every two weeks to be productive on the staff and then work for another 2 weeks, and hopefully get there by September and stay for the rest of the month. But during that time, guys like Larry Anderson, you know, was a character in himself. He gravitated towards me, and he was – you know, he was truthful with me about, you know, my approaches. I worked hard. I had a good work ethic, but he would tell me the little ins and outs of how to pump the brakes once in a while and not overexert myself when I'm training and things like that. To say, listen, you've got to give your body time to rest, and it's a long season, and you're gonna want to burn yourself out. And the guys that can last the longest are going to make it the longest. They're going to be around longer. So he took me under his wing. You know, a lot of guys like, you know, Atlee Hammaker, Bruce Hurst was great. A lot of those guys are, you know, my first year, you know, I grew up in Southern California. So guys like Jack Clark that I emulated, my dad was a big fan of Jack Clark. Keith Hernandez, when I was with the Mets, I came up to the big leagues spring training in 87. They just won the World Series in 86. And here was another item. So being in big league camp with Keith Hernandez was a thrill for me. One of the funniest guys around. That guy is very smart and very funny. I really enjoyed to be around him. And then I get traded to go to San Diego Padres, and Jack Clark is our first baseman, you know. So I was thrilled. And then also I grew up with a guy named Fred Lynn. He was older than us, and he was out of my hometown as well. And he was in left field for the San Diego Padres. So we had going on that team was, you know, Benito Santiago catching, Jack Clark at first, Roberto Alomar at second, Gary Templeton at short, Mike Palgarogo at third, Fred Lynn in left, we had Joe Carter in center, and Tony Gwynn in right. It was, you know, I'm just like, I can just throw the ball up anywhere, and it's going to get caught somewhere, it's going to get picked. So it was really nice to do that and have a team behind you like that. But guys like Larry Anderson, Tony Gwynn was very nice with the young guys. You know, he kept to himself for the most part, but he was very nice with the guys, and he tried to give the guys confidence and things like that. Some funny guys, like, you know, it was really nice to be around. Also, I was around a guy named Mike Maddox, Greg Maddox's brother.
Yep.
That was one of the guys that we really talked a lot more with pitching. You know, he'd ask me, you know, why did you throw that breaking ball on that count right there? And I said, well, I'm just looking at his tendencies, and I remembered it before what I was setting him up with. And he'd really talk about strategy with pitching, and I can see why he's a pitching coach now, because that's all he would say. We go out for a run, we come back, and every pitcher in the major league does a crossword puzzle. I was never a crossword puzzle guy ever growing up or anything like that, but all of a sudden, you know, we're all doing the USA Today every day, either at home or on the road, because we get the USA Today delivered to the room. And so we would do the crossword puzzle and talk baseball and talk about, like, what's that you throw sometimes? Is that a curveball? And I'm like, no, I don't throw a curveball, but I throw like a slurve once in a while, because, you know, if I see the same team the next week and they see me fastball slider, you know, I'm going to have to throw something else. And I threw a curveball in college, but it's not very good. So I just throw it first pitch just to show. And if I get away with it with a strike, the guy's thinking, Well, first of all, Rich doesn't throw a curveball, but if he throws that again, I'm gonna hit it a mile. But Rich ain't throwing that again because I just wanted to show something. So we would have good discussions like that. He's like, well, here's what I would do in that situation as well. So guys like that, Larry Anderson, Mike Maddox, are really guys that I got early. So as I got older, you know, we talked more baseball. I remember I ran into Russ Ortiz. I played in the Giants one time with, and great guy. We still keep in touch. And I think we were at Caesar's Palace, and I'm walking down, and I bump into him, and he was like, hey, Rich, good to see you. He goes, you know what? I was thinking about you last year. He goes, I was with the Diamondbacks. I was having an off day, so I went off. I went from the dugout to the bullpen to sit with the relievers. And he said they were, you know, not really paying attention to the game, and they weren't really, you know, focused in. He's like, I remember you guys in the bullpen, and I would make a visit, and you guys were glued to the TV watching the umpire strike zone, knowing if the umpire was going to pull the trigger on a 3-2 count on the low fastball way, and if he wasn't going to do that, I can't throw that in a situation coming in because I'm not going to get that call. Looking at a chart, and talking baseball, he goes, what a difference between, you know, and that's what I learned from the San Diego Pirates, guys like Larry and Mike Maddox. It taught me, you know, focus, learn tendencies, and if you could get as many numbers. You remember that this is a time when Tony Gwynn was doing videotaping for hitters.
Right.
You know, he was videotaping all the hitters and pitchers. And so everybody started talking about that. So guys were focusing and saying, well, let's learn tendencies as well, because now the cat's out of the bag when Tony Gwynn's talking about his tapes and his videoing pitchers. They're looking to see what our tendencies are. We better start seeing what their tendencies are as well. And we always had a TV in the bullpen as well. So we got to see the strike zones. We got to see what the guys would say. The guy wanted to start hitting everything in the right field, you know, wherever. Because we didn't have a lot of videotape then, you know, as we do now. But so as you got older and you get in the bullpen, you kind of wanted to talk ball with those guys and show the other younger guys what it takes to have at least hopefully a long enough career where you can be, you know, you can retire from it, actually. So it was a lot of, you know, trying to keep guys' confidence levels up. You know, you've seen a lot of crash and burns throughout the years where guys just beat themselves up, you know, for whatever reason, you know. And there's a special animal, you know, and it's not necessarily confidence. You know, it's a psyche you have to have to, have a bad day, pick it apart for about an hour, and then throw away the bad stuff and hang on to a piece of the good stuff, and then build off of that the next day. So sometimes you run into some guys you can help, and sometimes you run into some guys you can't help. But you know, sometimes you got to stay away from the guys that are just going to wear you down, you know, because they're just not going to try to get better because their psyche isn't like that. But like I said, you know, weight training was different. You know, guys were getting taken care of their bodies more, you know, and then all of a sudden halfway through the season, you know, all of a sudden you start seeing the steroids come out. And you don't really see anybody doing it, but now you're seeing other guys getting bigger and stronger. You're like, where'd this guy come from? You know, I mean, I remember I'd throwing pitching and having guys that would take the ball to right center, maybe a three hopper or two hopper off the wall, now hitting the wall or going over the right center field wall, you know. So that's when weight training started coming in. So during that time, from time to 1996 all the way to 2003, really there wasn't any more of that love of the game and talking strategy. It was also basically just getting bigger, stronger, and faster. That's what it was all about. Bigger, stronger, faster, and not so much of the analyzing the game so much, because that now a lot of the analytics are taking over during that time, you know, starting to come creep in.
Right.
So, you know, your opinion of what you should be doing doesn't matter anymore, because they had guys, Ivy League guys, that were coming in and showing you analytics.
Yeah, and before we even touch on that, I want to go back to the steroid guy. So you kind of peg it as 1996, you know, and we all know 98, and, you know, and we just watched the whole 30 for 30 documentary about 98. And yes, you know, it brought eyeballs back to the game. It brought, you know, advertising back to the game, yada, yada, yada. But that's a great point of 96. So you kind of could see when guys were just turned. And, you know, and we'll take out the, you know, the anomaly, the guy who hits 50 home runs one year, just he has a good year. This time, there's definitely something that's aiding them. And as a pitcher, you can see, and maybe you even know, because, you know, you're in the locker room, but, you know, you can see it as a pitcher that there's a change happening.
Well, you know, I didn't even, you know, you don't really see it because it's an off season thing. So, you know, everybody goes their separate way, except some guys will live maybe in the same city or so. But you don't really see it, you know, but you start to notice it. You start, wow, that guy got pretty big pretty quickly, you know. And I was really in denial. I didn't think anybody was doing anything, you know. I saw these guys all of a sudden who I know. I grew up in the San Gabriel Valley. We played against Damien in high school. You know, we grew up again. I played against some of the guys that were doing, you know, when Sosa and McGuire. I grew up with McGuire, you know, down the street. So, I seen him at USC and I seen him in my life. But what I'm trying to say is that, you know, I didn't really notice anything. I was just saying, wow, you know, this guy, I need to have a different approach in pitching now. He seems to be able to lift the ball when he couldn't lift the ball before. So I better try to get above the strike zone and not below the strike zone. So I was trying to figure out a way to get around these guys that were getting bigger and stronger. But then, you know, little by little, you're like, there's something going on with these guys. There's something going on. And then, about 96, 97, I start to see it right before I got hurt in 95 and rehabbing. And then I start to see a little bit of how to get bigger and stronger, not for me. And around when I got to, I would say around 96, 97, when I start to see, we didn't really see full blown until 98 because it kind of got in our face because of the strike and all that, but it had been brewing for a while. And other teams too. It started somewhere kind of like a Johnny Appleseed goes from team to team. You know, and you can see how that team, certain teams start to get bigger and stronger. Certain guys, and not everybody, of course, on that team was doing, you know, but there's certain guys on certain teams. You start to see things start to change on different teams, you know. And, you know, I mean, you see little guys that all of a sudden are, you know, 30 pounds heavier, bigger. But then you start to see them break down as well. A lot of back problems, a lot of. You
know, right.
I would say around 96, 97 when I start to see. You know, oh, wow, this is and, you know, unfortunately, the flip side of that is when the names started coming out and we started knowing who got caught and who was on list and things like that. You're like, seriously, guy? Yeah, you hit 210, you know, you did all this with 210, you know, it's like there was guys that got on the list that didn't really improve their career. But I guess they had to take a chance at it. You know, what could they do? You know, it's a business. At the end of the day, it's fun if you're good, and it's a business at the same time because it's all about numbers, and you're rated on your numbers, you're evaluated on your numbers, and if your numbers aren't there, there's another guy right below you that's looking to take your job, and you got to stay on top of it. So some guys, you know, they have to do what they have to do and figure out the game. Just like I said, everybody's taking doing analogies and they're making adjustments, and they thought maybe that this steroid was a way to give them an adjustment and an advantage. Some of them, you know, I know that did it because they couldn't compete on their normal skill set with some of the other guys who were. So, and they got a little tired of all that notoriety coming to some other guys as opposed to themselves. And that's one of the other reasons they felt like they had to do it. Not that they should have done it, but they feel like they had to do it because there was no way they were going to compete without it against these other guys. So, you know, it was wrong, but at the same time, if baseball is going to allow that to happen, because there's no drug testing at this time. There was none at all. Once you got to the major leagues, there was no drug testing whatsoever. The union would not allow it. So they figured out a way to get around that, you know, circumvent that that particular drug. And it just, you know, it was once that happened and all that notoriety came in the 33rd you're talking about, once that happened, everybody said, well, then, you know, wow, then I'm going to do it too. You know, all this, you know, this, it brought baseball back. Yes, we just came off that strike. Everybody was bitter about that. And they wanted to put people in the seats, and that whole thing was, you know, watching every day. You know, I made that, I gave up, I think, believe number 27 to Mark McGuire. he hadn't hit a home run to me at all in like 7 years, and I threw a slider down and in, and I'm figuring, you know, he hit the ball, and I'm thinking, okay, maybe it's a line drive to left, or maybe it's going to be a one-hopper off the wall. And it cleared right over that wall in 2 seconds. I was like, well, that was good for him. But anyway, I remember they entered after the game was over, they interviewed me, and they said, so how do you feel about that home run? And I said, well, it looks like I made Sports Center. That's all I care about. And at the end of the year, they made a book of every pitcher that gave up a home run, and he gave them out to everyone. And
oh.
I have a book of all the home runs, and then everybody has their own page and all their quotes and stuff like that. So it was pretty cool. It turned out to be a good thing.
Yeah, that's very cool. And, you know, and again, it's kind of funny that you bridge the gap between coming in the late 80s and going out in the early 2000s where, yeah, by the time the mid 2000s hit, that's where I think some of the, you know, maybe some of the substances subsided a little bit. And now we're into the massive weight training and people overtraining and tearing and ripping and pulling and stuff that completely changes the game. And I don't want to take up the rest of your night, so I don't want to go into it, but just quickly on the analytics, because you mentioned that before, and two more things I want to get to before we wrap. The analytics being what they are, like, where do you fall in the analytic debate? Because everybody has analytics at some point. I mean, it's just been called different things. Davey Johnson, who was the skipper of the Mets when you were coming up, was one of the first guys to really even talk about on-base percentage in the 70s. So there's analytics in every different facet, but now it's kind of on a different playing field. So where do you kind of fall in the analytics debate?
Well, you know, if you look at if the analytics are hurting anybody, it's hurting the hitters because of the shift and all that. So as a pitcher, I'm all for it because at the end of the day, all I want to do is win and keep my ERA down. You know, I want to win and keep my ERA down. And if the shift is going to do that, some of these guys like the Albert Pujols, you know, that guy really suffered on the shift, you know, a pull hitter. They would I enjoy this. I'm not a purist where it has to have everybody in the same spot. You know, it's like inventing the curveball. It's not fair. It's not the fastball anymore. It's the same thing. The game's evolving, you know. But there's going to be an adjustment. I think they went to too much of an extreme, actually. And I think little by little, the needle's going to be pulled back just a little bit more where it becomes a little bit more of the game we're used to in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But analytics-wise, I'm all for that. You can see, you know, what was happening with the analytics were so strong that, you know, the scouting reports are so strong that cheating, which I don't think cheating has been around. I mean, I'm not naive about this, but I would never play on a team that was banging any drums or giving signals or signs or anything like that. But I mean, I'm sure a couple of hitters, maybe they had a little signal back and forth from second base to first base. If they can get away with it and you're tipping your signs, well, that's your fault. You know, if you're tipping your signs, that's your fault. If you've got your signs can be decoded, then that's your fault. Because I know every team is filming the other coaches and they're trying to decode their signs. And if you get decoded, that falls on you. Because that's what the whole name of the game is, not to let them know what's coming or what your strategy is. But when it comes to the shifts and things like that, I'm all for it. I have no problem with that. But what's problem is right now, what's sexy is home runs and strikeouts. Guys throwing 100 miles an hour and guys hitting the ball on the third tier. So that's kind of gotten away and it's kind of hurting some of the minor league guys that are coming up. That's where the weight training is so important now. Guys feel like if they're not big and strong, they're not going to compete. Even if they have a great skill set, the slick fielding infielder, you know, the guy's got to be 6'2", 210 now. They can't be this 5'7" guy that Gallego and those guys back in the day, you know, they could remember those guys. You're not going to see a lot of those guys. You know, there's one exception to the rules with the kid from Houston. But other than that, you know, he still hit bombs too, you know. So the analytics I'm all for. I don't have a problem with that, especially as a pitcher. I'm sure the hitters would say things different about that. But as far as a pitcher, and you know if I put this ball in a certain spot, that ball's going to be hit in a certain spot, and you got three guys standing right there. As a pitcher, I'm all for it.
Yankees brought in a fifth infielder in the exhibition game against the Mets Saturday night. So, and guess what? They got beat. Right line drive, right? I can't remember who it was. Right line drive, right over whatever would be wherever the second baseman was positioned, right over his head.
Right. So. Yeah. And then, you know, the good news is that guys were refusing to give in to the shift. They were like, I'm not going to bunt. I'm not going to hit it the other way. I'm going to stay true to what I'm going to do. I'm going to beat the system. And they start showing that they won't be able to beat the system. So they're starting to make adjustments now. So now they're starting to make adjustments. Then now you got analytics going to make an adjustment. That's a needle's going to be pulled back a little bit more. But yeah, you're right. That was in an exhibition game. I saw that. It was pretty.
It was Thomas Nito, the light hitting catcher, backup catcher for the Mets. And he right over the second baseman's head and he beat it. So I would push the guy back after
that. Right.
Yeah, that's great. So, and then before we get into the wrap up, and I want to talk about Elite Nine again, you mentioned going back to the Mets and getting the championship ring in 2000. So from a playing perspective, you're coming back. You weren't done with your career, but you're coming back to an organization that you were drafted with and came through the ranks. Was it a little self-fulfilling for you to finally step across the lines at Shea Stadium?
Yeah, it was. You know, it was you know, New York is always tough to play in. I didn't do well, actually. You know, maybe it was better that I did go to San Diego. It was a smaller market team. Everything's fine and dandy with everybody in San Diego. It's cool breeze all day long over there. And then coming to the Gotham City out there in New York, was, you know, but yeah, it was always great. It's good back. It was good to go back. And Steve was my second baseman in the minor leagues, and then he turned out to be the general manager.
Oh yeah, that's right. Okay.
And in New York, so it was nice to have him give me a call and said, "Hey, you know, your former second baseman is offering you a 2-year deal," and I was just like, "Wow." So that was nice, and you know, it was really a great team to another great team. You know, Piazza catching, you had Zio, you had Bobby Yagi, you had, you know, we had a really good staff as well, and everybody was nice. Everybody was great. Franco was amazing. They all were great. Doug, Dennis Cook, we, you know, Robin Ventura, you know, on and on and on we could go. What a great club. And, you know, we had Bobby Valentine at the helm, and, you know, and say what you will, some of these guys, but I just was really impressed. Joe Torre in St. Louis, Dusty Baker in San Francisco. I saw these strategists, you know, and then I saw Bobby run those circles around in the playoffs against the Giants in the first round,
yeah,
and then Cardinals in the second round, and then he came head to toe with Joe Torre, and I was like, oh, this is going to be good, because you know, I really thought we had a better team, and obviously the team that wins is the best team, but you know, that first game, you know, was tough to give that up was really tough,
yeah,
but. I was living in Connecticut not long ago. My wife and I, and now we're back on the West Coast. But and I was living in Stamford, Connecticut with Bobby Valentine.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I ran into him a few times. He asked me to come to a luncheon with his a group, and it was really neat. He's a really good guy. Really, it was really nice to see him again. But yeah, it was good to be a Met again, and you know, that whole nostalgia of coming up to the Met organization was really special to me, and then seeing some of the old coaches still around, you know, Mr. Jackson was our bullpen coach, and he was the one that was in the instructional leagues all a lot with Cumberland and those guys. Al Jackson was our bullpen coach, and so to see all the coaches that I had in the instructional leagues and the minor leagues, the Rovers and all that, now we're in the system in the major league level, was really neat to see, and I was very fortunate to have that experience again.
It's great. And if they, if you could have won game one, it's a different series. We could argue at every bar in New York and New Jersey until the cows come home. Win game one, different series, because they almost came back in game two off Rivera. I mean, so it was. Yeah. I'm opening up wounds, Rich. I don't want to go back deep into them. So before we wrap up, I'd like to hit you with a couple stats. Usually our producer extraordinaire would do that, but he's having some connection issues. So we like to throw some Rich Rodriguez trivia at you and see if you can answer. So I'm looking at a guy here that he handed you pretty good. This is a guy that was tough to get out. He hit .685 with 3 home runs against you. Could you name who this fella was?
Well, the guy who really gave me, who was a thorn in my side, that I don't know why, because I'm going to guess Mark Grace.
Bingo. You nailed it. Very nice.
That guy, he would cut down his swing. You know, most of the lefties want to speed their swing up a lot. You know, your Ken Griffey's, your Barry Bonds, those guys. And so he cut his swing down. So that took my slider away. So when he cut it down, he'd go to the left side. And he would just know, you know, if I'm going to drop a two-seamer down and in to get ahead. And that's when he hit this home runs, you know. But yeah, Mark Grace, hats off to that guy. That guy could rake.
That's impressive. .685, that's something to shake a stick at.
No.
So. Not bad, but
to the Cubs. When I went to the Cubs, they killed all that.
So there you go. So how about this? So a guy that in the most, I'm going to just two names off to you, two Hall of Famers. Larry Walker hits .222 against you and holding a guy in check that could hit you all over the field. And Jeff Bagwell hit .200 against you. So something about those guys, did you kind of pump up a little bit more facing those big guns?
No, you know, Montreal was a great place to pitch, and so was the Astrodome. One of my two favorite places to pitch, but Jeff refused to cut his swing down, And so knowing that he was not going to cut his swing down, I had the advantage. And with Larry, TF 200 is good, but here's how smart that guy is. So guys like that, Robert Fick, dudes like that, these guys would wait for the right moment. Like you know, game-winning RBIs, I bet you he's got like four off of me. You know, that 200 batting average, he'd wait for the right moment, and then he'd flip that fastball or slider to left, and he just hit one down the line with a man on second, boom, and the game's over. You know, he's done that to me a few times. So, yeah, that's, you know, then when he didn't want to cut his swing down and he wanted to, you know, hit it out of up in the upper deck, you know, that's when I had the advantage. But when he wanted to cut his swing down, that's when he got me. So those hits that he does have, those are game-winning RBIs probably.
I could close my eyes and see the line drive just going right down the line. So I know exactly what you're talking about. Now, this is the guy you had seems to be the most success in the most at-bats. He went 2-for-28 against you.
2-for-28.
2-for-28. Good for a .083 average.
let's see. Let me guess.
All-star, great glove.
All-star, great glove. Great glove. So, my shortstop or
No. Think Arizona Diamondbacks. Think around that that time frame.
Who was it?
Steve Finley.
Steve started with the Montreal Expos as well.
Yeah.
Okay, Steve Finley. Really? Yeah. Well, Padres, right?
Padres and Arizona. Yeah. Yep.
Now it's coming back to me. Yes, Finley. Well, another good hitter. Really, wow, that's pretty good. I have to look at some of those stats.
How about that, right? That's what the beauty is. We get to dig deep. So you did very well in Rich Rodriguez trivia. We'll give you you all the credit in the world for that. So as we head into the wrap up here, the floor is yours to again talk about Elite Nine, where the listeners can learn more about it, about the great instructors you have, and the mission statement, which again I love and support. Anything having to do where the former pros are taking care of each other. So you please, the floor is yours, and share all the information.
Well, it's Elite Nine. It's at elite9.com. We go to the website and give yourself a chance to see some of the Major League Baseball players and where their facilities are at. And also just look around in your local community and see what other Major League Baseball players that are there and just go in and talk with them and have a little talk, because there's so much talk that's going on. It's such a diluted area right now when it comes to travel team ball. And it used to be where travel teams were, where they wanted to get the cream of the crop, and they wanted to get away from what they call, quote, daddy ball. And now the daddies have gone into travel ball. So it's saturated there too as well. So these travel balls, put them it's a pinhole in them and tell them, you got to come to my facility if you're going to be on my travel team. And so it's kind of really political out there. And the only people that suffer are the kids. And the parents feel like they're kind of handcuffed. And if they don't go to this, to this facility, that they're not going to make it to the major leagues because this guy, he knows, or at least college ball, I'm a recruiter. So they kind of have a lot of scare tactics out there. All I would say was just, you know, go into your local facility with a Major League Baseball. Google your closest facility in Major League Baseball. If you have any trouble, go to elite9.com and we will definitely send you the information you need to have. Give those guys a chance to tell their wealth and knowledge and know what it takes to develop your kid from the ground level up, the right way, and cut all this fat out of the way so that these kids can have a chance to have a straight beeline. You know, at the end of the day, what are we trying to do? We're trying to have fun. One, we're trying to keep them healthy. We're trying to give them an opportunity maybe to make the high school baseball team. And if they're fortunate enough, maybe parlay that into some college education. And then after that, the sky's the limit, and everything after that is gravy. So our focus now is to get them healthy so they can participate into their high school level. And then from there, hopefully, maybe they get enough, develop enough to have enough talent to go to the college level. And from there, after that, it's gravy, you know. And that was my whole goal, was just to go to D1 college and get an education. And I was fortunate enough to get the chance to go to the major league. So there's a lot to offer with these Major League Baseball players. And I'd encourage you guys to go and give themselves a shout.
Absolutely. And on Facebook, it's Elite Nine Baseball Camps and Clinics. So if anybody wants to reach out in the social media world, that's a great destination for it. And there you have videos, you have links, you have all the whole nine yards, and a YouTube page too, where, trust me, I was watching your grip on how to throw the ball the right way. And I'm sitting here going, look, I'm way past my prime. I don't need to worry about anything, but I'm watching it and thinking I could go to school the girls out here, my kids, and throw a couple past them. But this has been a lot of fun. I appreciate you spending all the time here tonight and taking a stroll back down memory lane and talking about some great moments in your career and Elite Nine. And we wholeheartedly support you on Diamond Conversation. So I just personally want to thank you before we say goodbye.
Thank you for having me, Nathan. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. So if you want to catch more of this on Diamond Conversations, it's for me, it's at Chad EMB on Twitter. For the producer extraordinaire, it's at Doug Barclay 17. And again, thank you, Rich, for being with us. And that's enough out of us today. We will catch you next time.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture.